This recording accompanies the Language B Higher Level Examination, Paper 2, Listening Comprehension, for English, November 2025.
Cet enregistrement accompagne l'examen de Langue B, Niveau supérieur, Épreuve 2, Compréhension orale d'anglais, novembre 2025.
Esta grabación acompaña el examen de lengua B, nivel superior, prueba 2, comprensión auditiva, de inglés, noviembre 2025.
The start and end of each audio text will be indicated by this sound.
Le début et la fin de chaque texte audio seront indiqués par ce son.
El inicio y el final de cada texto de audio se indicarán con este sonido.
The end of the examination will be indicated by this sound.
La fin de l'examen sera indiquée par ce son.
El final del examen se indicará con este sonido.
Text A. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a presentation about ways to bring the older and younger generations together.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to this presentation on how your town can promote contact between generations. I didn't expect such a big crowd. You may know, the problem of people feeling alone is now a global trend. One contributing factor to this is aging societies. An aging society is one where the average age is rising because people are living longer and having fewer children. This population shift, combined with people spending so much time online, is reducing chances for different age groups to mix, and it can have negative effects. For example, a lack of both understanding and trust can develop between generations. One way this can be addressed is through multi-generational living, wherein an older person shares their home with a young person, usually a student or recent graduate. This benefits young people, as they pay less than they would living alone, and it's often possible to further reduce their rent by helping the elderly person with tasks. This has obvious benefits for the elderly, but the best aspect of this arrangement is that older people are engaged rather than being alone all the time. However, it's not recommended that the young person take on the role of carer for the elderly person, as this can demand a lot of time that students may lack, especially during exam time. So that is something to consider. Now let's look at another option for intergenerational contact, as shown in the next slide. Now, having childcare centers in care homes is not a new concept. In fact, the first care home to do this was started in Japan in 1976. Many countries have since utilized this model, including the UK and Singapore. There are benefits for both elderly residents and children. Elderly people tend to be healthier and have better mental functioning. More importantly, they gain an enhanced sense of purpose and enjoy chatting and laughing with others. For children, they develop their social skills and levels of maturity. At the same time, they become more dependable. Staff also plan many activities that both groups enjoy, such as singing and playing instruments or parties. There is also spontaneous contact. For example, children often like dropping in for lunch with their elderly friends or exchanging notes with them. However, there are considerations to opening this type of care home. Firstly, a large investment is needed for setup. In addition, government rules can make it harder to start new integrated centers. Such centers require flexibility that might not comply with the rules. So, I hope this information helps you make the right choices for your town.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to this presentation on how your town can promote contact between generations. I didn't expect such a big crowd. You may know, the problem of people feeling alone is now a global trend. One contributing factor to this is aging societies. An aging society is one where the average age is rising because people are living longer and having fewer children. This population shift, combined with people spending so much time online, is reducing chances for different age groups to mix, and it can have negative effects. For example, a lack of both understanding and trust can develop between generations. One way this can be addressed is through multi-generational living, wherein an older person shares their home with a young person, usually a student or recent graduate. This benefits young people, as they pay less than they would living alone, and it's often possible to further reduce their rent by helping the elderly person with tasks. This has obvious benefits for the elderly, but the best aspect of this arrangement is that older people are engaged rather than being alone all the time. However, it's not recommended that the young person take on the role of carer for the elderly person, as this can demand a lot of time that students may lack, especially during exam time. So that is something to consider. Now let's look at another option for intergenerational contact, as shown in the next slide. Now, having childcare centers in care homes is not a new concept. In fact, the first care home to do this was started in Japan in 1976. Many countries have since utilized this model, including the UK and Singapore. There are benefits for both elderly residents and children. Elderly people tend to be healthier and have better mental functioning. More importantly, they gain an enhanced sense of purpose and enjoy chatting and laughing with others. For children, they develop their social skills and levels of maturity. At the same time, they become more dependable. Staff also plan many activities that both groups enjoy, such as singing and playing instruments or parties. There is also spontaneous contact. For example, children often like dropping in for lunch with their elderly friends or exchanging notes with them. However, there are considerations to opening this type of care home. Firstly, a large investment is needed for setup. In addition, government rules can make it harder to start new integrated centers. Such centers require flexibility that might not comply with the rules. So, I hope this information helps you make the right choices for your town.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text B. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a discussion between a radio host and an art historian, Professor Jones, about the importance of art.
Is art important? To discuss this with me is Professor Jones from the local college. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm here today to advocate for more arts provision in schools. Naturally, this is also an appeal for greater investment in arts education.
I'd argue that other areas of education deserve more funding. For example, science and maths classes teach skills needed for jobs.
Actually, artistic self-expression encourages innovative thinking and problem-solving skills too. Although it has to be said that students tend to learn these skills more from some types of art than others, for example, painting and sketching, rather than singing.
Well, certainly some art is more relevant to teaching those skills. What about cooking? Some would call that culinary art, but I can't agree.
Many dishes are extremely visual, but I'd argue this is a science rather than an art form. But I do want to stress that art studies go beyond nurturing the skills we've discussed. Art students also achieve higher reading and math scores, and the study of art reduces truancy, although I have to admit that it was history classes that motivated me to be in school.
Really? I never missed days when I had art class.
Well, beyond education, art plays an important role in well-being. It can reduce anxiety and depression.
Surely advances in well-being are the most important aspect then?
Many might agree, but we can't overlook the skills relevant to work. Teamwork and analytical skills are facilitated through art. These are significant employability skills.
Yes, I recall successful collaborative art projects from school. Oh, it's time now for a break. Welcome back. Now, Professor, what about art as protest? I've read that art is as influential as books in terms of promoting social change.
Yes, we often think of graffiti when we think of protest art, but many people don't realise that it also encompasses other types, such as murals and posters.
I've seen examples like that in museums, especially from the 20th century. I'd imagine that the internet plays a role now, though.
Indeed. Protest art has evolved immensely for that reason, and now has the power to influence even more people. However, artists often need to embed their protest message. So those critical thinking skills from art classes can help interpret their meaning.
It seems that art and culture are also inherently intertwined.
Yes. Another equally important aspect of artistic expression is culture. Art preserves culture in a way that words cannot, because it fosters a sense of belonging among members. This emotional response makes it integral to nurturing identity.
Is that still as relevant in the days of social media? People seem willing to merge their cultures now, leading to more variety in cultural art.
That makes conserving the original cultural art even more significant, because current and future generations will recognise the uniqueness of their culture. These are just some of the reasons I hope we'll see more art funding in the next academic year.
Thanks for joining us today, Professor.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Is art important? To discuss this with me is Professor Jones from the local college. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm here today to advocate for more arts provision in schools. Naturally, this is also an appeal for greater investment in arts education.
I'd argue that other areas of education deserve more funding. For example, science and maths classes teach skills needed for jobs.
Actually, artistic self-expression encourages innovative thinking and problem-solving skills too. Although it has to be said that students tend to learn these skills more from some types of art than others, for example, painting and sketching, rather than singing.
Well, certainly some art is more relevant to teaching those skills. What about cooking? Some would call that culinary art, but I can't agree.
Many dishes are extremely visual, but I'd argue this is a science rather than an art form. But I do want to stress that art studies go beyond nurturing the skills we've discussed. Art students also achieve higher reading and math scores, and the study of art reduces truancy, although I have to admit that it was history classes that motivated me to be in school.
Really? I never missed days when I had art class.
Well, beyond education, art plays an important role in well-being. It can reduce anxiety and depression.
Surely advances in well-being are the most important aspect then?
Many might agree, but we can't overlook the skills relevant to work. Teamwork and analytical skills are facilitated through art. These are significant employability skills.
Yes, I recall successful collaborative art projects from school. Oh, it's time now for a break. Welcome back. Now, Professor, what about art as protest? I've read that art is as influential as books in terms of promoting social change.
Yes, we often think of graffiti when we think of protest art, but many people don't realise that it also encompasses other types, such as murals and posters.
I've seen examples like that in museums, especially from the 20th century. I'd imagine that the internet plays a role now, though.
Indeed. Protest art has evolved immensely for that reason, and now has the power to influence even more people. However, artists often need to embed their protest message. So those critical thinking skills from art classes can help interpret their meaning.
It seems that art and culture are also inherently intertwined.
Yes. Another equally important aspect of artistic expression is culture. Art preserves culture in a way that words cannot, because it fosters a sense of belonging among members. This emotional response makes it integral to nurturing identity.
Is that still as relevant in the days of social media? People seem willing to merge their cultures now, leading to more variety in cultural art.
That makes conserving the original cultural art even more significant, because current and future generations will recognise the uniqueness of their culture. These are just some of the reasons I hope we'll see more art funding in the next academic year.
Thanks for joining us today, Professor.
You now have 2 minutes 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text C. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a podcast presenter give his views on factors involved in the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, to promote equality.
Welcome back to my podcast, where I give my opinion on anything and everything. In this week's episode, we'll look at utilizing artificial intelligence, or AI, to promote equality. Now, for those like me who aren't experts, what is artificial intelligence? AI is software technology with at least one of several capabilities. First, informative conversation in the form of chatbots, which I actually find highly irritating. But AI can also make more specialized decisions, such as diagnosing medical conditions, or it can apply logical reasoning. Thus, since AI can in theory be used to draw more impartial conclusions, it should lead to a more equitable society because algorithms dictate choices rather than people. However, despite assurances from AI developers, many public figures have voiced their concerns over the inherent bias built into algorithms, since they're generally programmed based on past data. For example, data on former bank loans is used to program AI to make fairer decisions on new applications, potentially eliminating discrimination, but the data itself can reflect partiality that was used in the original decisions, thus perpetuating the system. Therefore, AI needs to be programmed not only based on historical accuracy, but also on outcomes that would have been fairer. AI developers argue that humans are not good at detecting discrimination in the massive data sets used in machine learning, so AI must be involved in that process as well. But that means using AI, not humans, to judge what's used to program AI. I question the integrity of that situation, but I understand its need due to the sheer scale of the data sets. So, what are some of the applications of AI for promoting equality? I've mentioned an example from banking, but some experts also promote the use of AI in human resources to enable a fairer hiring system, since humans have unconscious biases. They argue that AI can enhance efficiency because it's faster in the selection and recommendation of candidates. Moreover, it could theoretically increase diversity in the candidate pool because it decreases bias in decision-making. So, it sounds like a viable solution, doesn't it? However, not many companies use it due to fear of disempowerment. While from applicants' perspective, one study showed that 67% felt the use of AI was unacceptable because humans should evaluate humans. So, although there is potential for more equitable hiring, many people aren't ready to accept AI as its source. Now, on an even bigger scale, I feel it's possible to use AI to promote equality in many of the United Nations Sustainability Development Goals. There are projects like developing AI tutors in education or using AI for water management, which I think is the most urgent due to climate change. Using AI to reduce corruption is another ongoing project. It's therefore clear that AI has potential to equalize society in many areas. However, one of the biggest concerns is that without greater transparency and ethics, AI could reinforce inequality instead of making us all more equal, thus not functioning as intended. Steps must also be taken to enable its acceptance by society at large, starting with clear laws in order to define what AI should and should not do. Thanks for listening.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Welcome back to my podcast, where I give my opinion on anything and everything. In this week's episode, we'll look at utilizing artificial intelligence, or AI, to promote equality. Now, for those like me who aren't experts, what is artificial intelligence? AI is software technology with at least one of several capabilities. First, informative conversation in the form of chatbots, which I actually find highly irritating. But AI can also make more specialized decisions, such as diagnosing medical conditions, or it can apply logical reasoning. Thus, since AI can in theory be used to draw more impartial conclusions, it should lead to a more equitable society because algorithms dictate choices rather than people. However, despite assurances from AI developers, many public figures have voiced their concerns over the inherent bias built into algorithms, since they're generally programmed based on past data. For example, data on former bank loans is used to program AI to make fairer decisions on new applications, potentially eliminating discrimination, but the data itself can reflect partiality that was used in the original decisions, thus perpetuating the system. Therefore, AI needs to be programmed not only based on historical accuracy, but also on outcomes that would have been fairer. AI developers argue that humans are not good at detecting discrimination in the massive data sets used in machine learning, so AI must be involved in that process as well. But that means using AI, not humans, to judge what's used to program AI. I question the integrity of that situation, but I understand its need due to the sheer scale of the data sets. So, what are some of the applications of AI for promoting equality? I've mentioned an example from banking, but some experts also promote the use of AI in human resources to enable a fairer hiring system, since humans have unconscious biases. They argue that AI can enhance efficiency because it's faster in the selection and recommendation of candidates. Moreover, it could theoretically increase diversity in the candidate pool because it decreases bias in decision-making. So, it sounds like a viable solution, doesn't it? However, not many companies use it due to fear of disempowerment. While from applicants' perspective, one study showed that 67% felt the use of AI was unacceptable because humans should evaluate humans. So, although there is potential for more equitable hiring, many people aren't ready to accept AI as its source. Now, on an even bigger scale, I feel it's possible to use AI to promote equality in many of the United Nations Sustainability Development Goals. There are projects like developing AI tutors in education or using AI for water management, which I think is the most urgent due to climate change. Using AI to reduce corruption is another ongoing project. It's therefore clear that AI has potential to equalize society in many areas. However, one of the biggest concerns is that without greater transparency and ethics, AI could reinforce inequality instead of making us all more equal, thus not functioning as intended. Steps must also be taken to enable its acceptance by society at large, starting with clear laws in order to define what AI should and should not do. Thanks for listening.
You now have the rest of the time to finish answering the questions.